Hey, this is the JRR, You Talking to Me podcast. It's the Helm's Deep Dive. Very exciting episode 4, a very exciting episode. And You Talking to Me, I don't see anyone else here but Jude Fox. Jude, how you doing tonight?
I am exhausted. I've been shooting orcs with a bow from the walls of Helm's Deep all night long.
Well, you know what? It keeps the elves young. So, you know, it's a good exercise. It's a good cardio, I hear. And that's good on you. So, tonight, Rowan was supposed to be here tonight. He mentioned something about a new girlfriend, a much older lady. And he's really smitten. I don't know, folks. Try to get in touch with him. And I thought he was going to be here tonight, but that's okay because we have all his notes. And basically, we're going to be talking about a lot of things tonight. The fallen elf theory in relation to Ada and the nature of good and evil. In Tolkien's world, in Tolkien's writing. And we're going to talk even a little bit about his response to Nietzsche in relation to his arch villains, Morgoth, Sauron, and now possibly Ada. We're going to talk about the Palantiri, the Seeing Stones, the nature of the Seeing Stones, also the lore surrounding them, and if the show is following the lore. We got some shout-outs on the actors, and maybe a little bit of opinionation about the title sequence. We haven't spoken about that yet. The lore surrounding that Numenorean lifespan, is it following the lore or not? We don't really know. And also, what's going on with the Harfoots and Meteor Man? We know they're going to make a big comeback in this next episode coming up. So just with that, I would like to say that in a past episode, I said, you know, there are there were no corrupted elves in terms of working with the enemy. That's not totally true. I rethought that, and I'd like to talk about a few elves of questionable morality. Jude, do you have any idea who I might be talking about when I talk about elves of questionable morality?
Well, the first one that jumps to mind is Eol.
Yes. Eol, what up, Eol? The dark elf. He is literally called...
Not to be confused with Eeyore.
No.
You know, the donkey from Winnie the Pooh. You don't want to mix them up.
What did he used to say all the time? Thanks for noticing me, or something like that. He was always so depressed. All right, so yes, Eol, the dark elf, of course, but the granddaddy of them all. And by granddaddy, I mean of Celebrimbor. Feanor, I think he is sort of really at root cause of some of this Eol stuff. And Meglin, Eol's son. And I've seen some theories about Adar and how it relates to these elves. I do not think that he is any one of these elves. But I would like to cover the lore on some of them right now. So... we're back in the olden days in the First Age, and we got Eol, and he is a Sindar. He's a Sindarin elf. And the thing about that is they never went to Valinor, and he never saw the light of the trees, and he liked the darkness, and this was before the sun was he was around before the sun was even there, as was Galadriel and Feanor and a whole host of other elves. But the thing that I'd really like to get is the story of his moral character. Okay, so he's living in a realm in the First Age called Doriath. And that was basically a realm that was run by the Noldor. And he was never comfortable there because he blamed the Noldor for Morgoth's returning to Middle-earth. And in a way he's right, and in a way he's wrong. Morgoth returns to Middle-earth with the Silmarils and Feanor, you know, in hot pursuit of the Silmarils. Now, Eol was known as the Dark Elf, as I said, and he was friends with the dwarves, and he was very skilled in metalwork. Do you know anything about Eol's metalworking, Jude? His swords or anything like that? Can you tell us anything?
Yes. Well, he discovered metal from a meteorite which had crashed to Middle Earth, and he forged two swords from that metal. The swords were of black metal. And I believe they were actually said to be sentient.
That's right. Sentient swords. So, like Feanor, we have someone who is truly unique in their skill set. And I think that this is going to come into play with Tolkien's notion of the evil of modernization. Now, of course, this, what do you mean modernization? Well, I think Tolkien is using this smithing ability as a sort of stand-in or metaphor for technology. And, of course, he saw the horrors of World War I, and to him, these tanks and airplanes were like dragons and monsters. They might as well have been. They were like these magical death machines. So Tolkien was, often he would equate the skill with beauty and grace and elegance, but also often with pride, arrogance, and in general, evil. Mom, Dad, don't touch it. It's evil. So, you're right. And the metal that he created was called Galvor. Anyway, so Eol lives, he gets out of Doriath. He doesn't like it there with the Noldor. And he goes and he lives in the Dark Forest where he dwells at night. And he likes that. And he meets the dwarves and they teach him skills of metalwork. And we know, we just discussed what he did with that.
He was like the original goth elf.
He was. He was the Dark Elf. And now he sees this lovely elven lady named Arathal. And Arathal was the daughter of Fingolfin. And we know him. He's of the Noldor. He was one of Feanor's half-brothers. And he is very much taken with Arathal, and he kind of like bewitches the forest and makes it so that she can't find her way back, and she ends up at his place, and he eventually marries her, okay? So they have a son, and his name is Meglin, and you know, Eol waits till he's about 12 years old to name him, and that means like sharp eye. He's got a keen eye. He decides to name him that. Anyway, Eol was not very nice to his wife and his son because she was of the Noldor, and he hated the Noldor, so he said, "You ain't ever gonna go see your folks. I don't like them."
A little domestic abuse there.
Yes. He basically kept her a little bit of a prisoner there. So already we can see that Eol he's a bit of a corrupt elf. He is a bit of a fallen elf, but he is still fair. He is not scarred in any way as you like an orc would be. He's not deformed physically. As you can see, Adar, if he is a fallen elf, he was corrupted physically. You can see some scarification on his face.
Eol, just grapes. A bit of a dick.
Just a bit of a dick. More than a bit of a dick. Anyway.
A full one?
Yeah, he's a full-on winky dinky do. So, he goes off and hangs out with the dwarves. They're having some big fest. It's, I don't know, it's Dwarf Fest, or I don't know, maybe like Blues Traveler was playing. I don't know who orcs would listen to. They seem like a Blues Traveler kind of people. Anyway, So Aol goes off to hang with the orcs, and Meglin goes to his mom. Let's get
Was it the orcs or the dwarves?
The dwarves. Did I say orcs?
You've been saying orcs.
I did? All right. Every time I said orcs, that's dwarves, okay? Simple as that. He goes to hang with the dwarves.
Orcs not big on Blues Traveler.
No.
They're more of a death metal kind of.
They like Dave tribe. Matthews. So, anyway, he's going to hang with the dwarves. You people know what I'm talking about. So, and his son and his wife, they get the fuck out of Dodge. They're like, let's go to Gondolin, the hidden city. And
that place will be safe forever.
Yeah, well, we know why. We're going to get into why. And so they do get there, and the Noldor are not happy when Aol comes to get him. And
he came to collect his.
Yes, and Turgon the king, he basically said, you took... Arathel, you married her. You didn't invite us to the wedding, dude. You didn't tell us you were doing this. You're not kin to us. You're not our, like, bro-in-law or anything like that. We don't
know.
No
open bar, nothing.
No. So, Aol, being the dark elf, he's got a reputation to protect, and he says to Turgon, I don't follow your rules, and this is going to come into play with my theories about the good and evil. He doesn't follow the rules that Turgon lays out, which is, you got to live here now or die. That's Turgon for you. Turgon, that's nasty old Turgon. Now, Turgon was a good elf. He had his rules, and live here or die. And Aol decides, I want to die, and I'm going to take my son out with me. Because he wanted to, he said, you can keep the wife. You can take the wife. I'm taking my son back. And they said, no, live here or die. And then he goes and he decides, if I'm going to die, I'm going to kill my son.
Yeah, they ain't going to keep his blood.
But he didn't do that. He accidentally kills his wife, Arathel.
Jumped in front of the spear meant for Meglin.
Right. The spear with the poison tip. It's like tickle. Yep. It's like tickle with the big wide ball. But this is spear with the poison tip. So anyway, so they cast him over this infamous cliff that they have, and he dead.
Yeah, they made a summary judgment and bye-bye.
And he dead. And she dead. But anyway, Meglin, that doesn't stop him from prospering in Gondolin. But, like his dad, it said that he loved his mom more, but he was a lot like his dad. And so he harbored a deep, passionate love for Idril. But Idril was his cousin. Creeper, Meglin, stop. No. That's a cousin. We don't do that. The Noldor don't do that. This is not your Game of Thrones sexy time show.
Okay? Yeah, there's a reason they're called the Noldor.
Yeah, the Noldor. No back door. So
that too.
Yeah. That's how elves do it. That's how they have their babies through the back door.
Yeah, they're I thought
very few people know that. Very few people.
Really? So, see, I thought that was the orcs. But,
that's
yeah.
Deep Tolkien lore.
Wow.
Anyway.
Rob Law going dirty, going blue.
Yeah, a little bit. So he falls in love with his cousin. She doesn't love him back. And this is the seed of hate that grows in this beautiful city, this prospering city of Gondolin. And you know who's going to use this seed of hate to his benefit, Jude? Do you know who's out there in the forest just awaiting on
Chris
the hate?
Kringle?
He's a-waiting on the hatin'. What his name is?
Kris Kringle?
Kris Kringle. His name is Morgoth Jude.
Oh, that guy. Yeah, I knew that.
And Meglin goes out past the city walls, and he's looking for some metals, some precious metals. You know, these prideful smiths are always, they're always looking for the precious metals. So some orcs captured him, and Morgoth tortured him for the secret passage to the city. But Morgoth also knew, because Morgoth had spies everywhere, that he hated Tuor. Tuor was like this big war hero. He returns to Gondolin, and he wins the hand of Meglin's beloved Idril. And he fucking hates this dude. And he hates the fact that Idril doesn't love him. And so Morgoth is like, okay, now that I'm done torturing you, I'll make a deal with you. You can be my vassal lord, and you can run the town of Gondolin, and you can have Idril's hand. But this isn't going to happen. He was cursed by his father when his father was executed, and his father said, "You're going to die just like me, you little traitor bitch." And he does.
How dare you not stand there and take the spear I threw at you?
Yeah, come on. And you know who kills him? It's Tuor, Idril's beloved and betrothed. And he throws him off that goddamn same thing, that same cliff. I can even tell you the name of it. Do you want to know the name of it, Jude?
I think we all want to know the name of it.
All right. Well, I'm going to tell you the name of it.
What's the name?
The name is... Amon-Gwareth.
Yeah.
Amon-Gwareth.
That's the one. That's it. That's the ticket.
And his father's curse is fulfilled. So, now we have...
Wasn't his death a little bit more brutal than just being thrown over there?
If you're talking about being pinned by one arm, that whole deal,
and hanging for weeks or something to that effect, right?
I have to look into that. That may be two different stories that I conflated. I'm not exactly sure because I was reading the Silmarillion today, didn't see that. That doesn't mean that didn't happen. I'd like to. We'll dive into that more.
We'll have to ask Rowan about it.
Yes, Rowan will know that shit up and down. Anyway. Not in his notes, though. So we have some morally corrupt elves, no doubt. Feanor killed his own kin in the kinslaying for their ships so that he could chase Morgoth. That was the seed, actually, of this hatred that Eol has for the Noldor. So not only is he dark by disposition, but he also has a right to really not... be so in love with this other group of elves. So you can see as one bad deed begets another in this. And then we have Meglin. So we have this trio of definitely not great elves who are doing things that, you know, we would normally ascribe to a villain.
Looked down upon.
Yes. It's frowned upon to kill a whole bunch of Teleri elves for their ships. They were such peaceful Teleris.
And relatives.
So, let's talk about the way Tolkien crafts evil. And I do think that a lot of it has to do with a response to Nietzsche and Nietzsche's will to power. Because Nietzsche died at the very beginning of the 20th century, and Tolkien, of course, he fought in World War I. All of Europe had this man's very, very modern ideas for the time. And it was God is dead, meaning there is no objective right or wrong. There is no objective morality. With the modernization, with science and everything else, we do not need this God stuff anymore, according to Nietzsche. As a matter of fact, the morality that the church puts over everybody and the conventions of society turn you basically into sheep, if you follow them. Come on, sheeple, wake up. That's what Nietzsche's saying. And he's like, you have to master yourself. You have to create your own truth. You have to create your own ethical system and make yourself into what he termed an Übermensch. And the need for the Übermensch to master himself and master others is the will to power. And power for Nietzsche's like all these other philosophers, they say they're looking for the truth. He calls bullshit. He says that that's a big lie and that everyone is just really after enough power to live freely, to empower themselves, and to basically, eventually, if they can, have power over others. But Nietzsche didn't think that brutality was the best way to gain this power. And he thought that it was through benevolence to the lesser-minded people. And that was the Übermensch's best way to gain power. And with the power, he gains more freedom. And with more freedom, he can create his own moral universe. Sound like anyone you know, Jude?
Well, I am thinking that it's kind of sounding like the same philosophy we heard from a certain elf-like character in our show called Adar.
100%. Adar says that the lie is so deep that even the roots and the rocks believe it, and that the whole world needs to be rebuilt. And then he's also very benevolent to the orcs, and this is for power. And I do believe that in Adar, we have the archetypical Nietzschean, what Tolkien would use as a villain, because he had a response. His work was a response to this will to power concept, saying that, yeah, you think that you're going to be benevolent when you're obtaining this power. But like putting on that ring, you think you're going to use it for good? You're not. Your absolute power will absolutely corrupt you. And you need to serve a higher power, a god, Iluvatar, or Tolkien was Christian. And if you don't serve that higher power, you are going to fall into depravity and corruption. And so we see Morgoth, we see Sauron, and now we see Adar, and Adar being the most archetypical because you can see his benevolence in action. But certainly Morgoth, he wanted to enact his will immediately. And he had really just all the Valar or the Ainur just had two choices, really. Do exactly as you're told. Sing the part that God gave you in the composition. Or do your own thing and basically not listen to God and then be forever evil. And that is what Morgoth, Melkor at that point, chose. He wanted to do his own thing, and that became the root of all evil.
And I think that the very concept, like that harkens back to the very concept of what is good and evil, and is free will evil if it contradicts the quote-unquote good that was already put in place? And, you know, how do people view that as an individual versus the way Tolkien would view it, which is through that strictly Catholic perspective of this is what has been laid out?
Right. And it's also a very interesting argument that why in terms of Christian ideology, why evil exists at all. And Tolkien is, everything is rooted in Ilúvatar. Ilúvatar is an omni-god, and the pantheon of gods that spring from Ilúvatar's mind all represent components of Ilúvatar. And Melkor is one of them. And, you know, you have to think that if Ilúvatar is the source of all things, he is also the source of evil, and evil is necessary because we need it to understand what good is. If there is no contrast, how can we understand what good is? And Adar would be someone who maybe religiously follows Morgoth or Melkor and doesn't believe in Ilúvatar. Believes in maybe the gods exist, but they're using the concept of Ilúvatar to keep their power and to keep people in line. And he wants to flip this, turn it on its head, and make it like they're the bad guys and he's indeed the good ones. So I really wanted to flesh that out and talk about Adar in that respect. Now, there are some theories that Adar might be Meglin. And that, I can't really see that. That really doesn't follow the lore. It doesn't make sense. He may be inspired by him, but I don't see that. Even though he is using a black blade to kill the orcs.
Yeah, I would definitely shoot that down as well, because without question, one way or the other, Meglin is canonically dead, according to Tolkien, and didn't even live very long. He was just a young boy of about 200, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. He's definitely dies. Undoubtedly dies in the Silmarillion. He is not Adar. Now let's move on, Jude. You want to talk about the Palantiri, the Seeing Stones, a little bit?
Ah, certainly. Well, so far in the show, we've been told that there were 7 Palantiri, and that the only one that is known to have not been lost at this point is the one that Queen Mariel has in her possession. This, however, differs quite a bit from what we know in the books, and that is that of the Palantiri, 7 of them were taken from Numenor by Elendil and his sons back to Middle-earth. So in order for him to have taken 7, the implication is that there were more than 7 to begin with. And of those 7, we know of, I believe, at least 3 or 4 by the time of Lord of the Rings. So the idea that there's only one left, or one that is not missing, seems a little contradictory to what we have in the Silmarillion as well as Lord of the Rings.
So a little book to show difference there.
Yes.
So what did you think of the way the when Galadriel laid hands upon the Palantir, I thought that was really well done. I love how that cracking effect at first when she puts her hands on it, like it's like super frigid inside of it. And then
the
all
way
of a sudden
it's being,
she's in there.
The way it's being handled is definitely very cool. I've got no objection to that whatsoever. I think it looked great.
I thought that was an interesting way to go, and certainly different than the Peter Jackson one, which was also good, but I found this one to be a little bit more compelling, seeing her actually inside the scene of the Palantir. Yeah. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the functionality of the Palantir in Tolkien's world. So the Palantir, and as Galadriel mentioned, it can be very misleading.
They have several uses.
Okay.
Because, I believe, as you're about to allude to, there's the visions, the potential futures they can show, but they can also simply be used as a Middle Earth video phone, essentially, you know, to literally see what another of the Palantiri are seeing. So you can use one of the Palantiri in order to view the area where another one is being held. And I don't know if they're going to mention that at all. They do basically show that in the Peter Jackson films and in the books. But right.
Like, you can check on your kids if your kids have their Palantir. Keep your Palantir turned on, okay? Don't let the charge go out. I need to know where you are.
That's literally one of their main purposes, you know, which is, why do you think Elendil saved the Palantir, you know, so he can keep an eye on his kids when they're off governing the other kingdoms?
God damn it, what's that Palantir doing at the mall? I told you should be home doing your homework. I check on the Palantir when it's in the mall. Anyway, so the Palantir, though, I want to say as a political tool, Sauron was known for mastering somebody else's mind that was using the Palantir. I'm thinking of Denethor, and also of showing just the right view of the future to make someone feel hopeless. Sauron was very good at that. And if you look at fascism, if you look at the rise of fascism, or any strongman ideology, the fear tactic about if you go down this path, the future for your country is going to be awful. And you're going to live an awful life if you follow the other party. This is
George Orwell was all about that.
Right. And I think that Tolkien was also all about that in terms of the Palantiri. We don't actually have those, but we do have people telling us what the future is going to be like every day if you go down the wrong path and why you should follow them. And I think that is the main function of the Palantiri in his writing. And also, of course, just the fact that even just connecting with the enemy, you're in a mental tug of war, a mental wrestling match with another. And Denethor was very prideful of his intellect, by the way, according to lore. And he was supposed to be very wise, and he thought he could master Sauron. Through the Palantir. And, of course, you know, he jumped off a cliff after trying to burn his son. Does that remind you of the other story of Eol and Maeglin at all?
I think that there's a lot of reoccurring themes in both Tolkien's work as well as the show that involve fathers and sons, and particularly sons paying for the sins of their fathers, which once again goes back to the theological inklings of Tolkien himself. And I think we're seeing a lot of that in the show as well right now, or at least the setup for it, which I'm looking forward to seeing how a lot of it's going to play out.
So how are you liking the acting so far? Because this is a TV show. We should talk a little bit about the actors. What are you thinking?
I am totally digging, I would say, all performances. There's not a performance in particular that I dislike. There are some I think I like more than others. And, of course, we briefly touched on it. But there's an actor or two that we may feel is a bit miscast. But that's not to take away from them doing their job in giving a great performance so far. So in terms of performance, I'm 100% about it. I think it's very well cast in that sense.
Is there any actor in particular that you want to mention?
Well, let's see. Some of the standouts to me so far are Joseph Malwi, I believe. And by the way, I'm probably going to butcher most of these names, and I apologize to you, the listener, and the actors themselves, because I do not mean to do so. But anyway, he plays Adar, and you may know him from Game of Thrones, where he played Benjen Stark, a.k.a. Cold Hands, as well as his unforgettable performance in the great Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, in which he played Thomas Lincoln. You know, I'm sure nobody can forget that. It's amazing. But so far, yeah, he's been one of the standouts, as well as Ishmael Cruz Cordova, who plays Arondir, just a killer so far in their scene. I believe it was only one scene, if I'm not mistaken. Together was one of the standouts in the show so far. In addition to that, I've already mentioned the performances by our Prince Durin the Fourth and Princess Disa, played by Owen Arthur and Sophia Namveti, respectively. And they have absolutely been killing it. Again, some of the other people have been terrific. I think, who is it? Charles Vickers, who plays Halbrand, has been a lot of fun. Lenny Henry, who is a famous British actor, comedian, and host, who plays Sadoc Burrows, and a lot of people may recognize. Once again, every scene he's in just kills it. Then we've got basically the rest of our main cast, once again, all of whom I think are excellent. You know, if there's one person, and we have mentioned it, so I'm not going to harp on it too much, that is a big standout in kind of a negative way, once again, not for his performance, is Charles Edwards, and that would be our very own Celebrimbor. Terrific actor. Nothing against him. Just feel that he was incredibly miscast. Personally, I had told Rob there and Rowan that we were all speaking, and I said after watching House of the Dragon, I think Matt Smith would have been an ideal Celebrimbor, and that's more the look that I would have gone for if I were casting. But again, that's just me.
You think Matt Smith was busy doing something?
You mean with like some other fantasy show that I haven't heard of or mentioned just now? I don't know why they didn't get
Shout out to House of the Dragon this week. That was intense and really, really a great episode. I really love Disa. I'm not sure the actress who plays her. It seems like she's a real, actual singer. I'm not sure, yeah, but you can tell the vocal technique.
That's Sophia Namveti.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the title sequence, okay? Like, I think it's a little bit of a Game of Thrones style ripoff. Now, HBO seems to nail the shit out of the title sequence usually. You know, Game of Thrones, the Westworld, is unlike any other title sequence I've ever seen. So good with the piano, and just they change it up all the time. And obviously HBO, the iconic one with the gears moving throughout the entire map of Planetos. from Essos to Westeros. And this I'm seeing, it seems a bit more CGI. It seems a bit more of an imitation of that style. It's not bad. I mean, it's visually pleasing to watch, but it's not a home run for me.
Yeah, I think you're correct in that HBO does generally knock it out of the park. They've won countless Emmys just for their opening sequences alone. I mean, you have things dating back, you know, if we go back a little bit, sequences like True Blood and like Carnival, and all the way back to like Tales from the Crypt, which was an iconic opening sequence with that Danny Elfman music and the practical pre-CGI miniatures that they used. They've always been a company that really pushed for strong opening sequences, and I think that influences a lot of the other creators out there. And I feel that a lot of the fantasy opening sequence we've been seeing lately, whether it's The Witcher or Wheel of Time or now The Rings of Power, have probably at the very least been influenced by that. But that being said, I think there's a few thematic elements which I am really appreciating in this opening sequence.
Yeah, maybe they just didn't have the money for it. Ba-da-ba-bam. Anyway, so the Lord.
Well, they did have the money to get the opening music, which was not Bear McCready, but that's actually Howard Shore who wrote that.
Yes.
The opening music for the titles, which is impressive. I feel.
I like it. Again, it's good, and I was really feeling it at the end of episode 4 that Bear McCready wrote. But, you know, enough of that. I'd like to move on. The Numenorean lifespan, legendarily, Elros lived to be 500 years. Numenoreans are supposed to live to be, 250, 350 years old, something like that.
Depends on the era.
We don't know if that's happening in the show.
No. We've got some suspicions, and I don't know that they're going to make too many people too happy, but again, we don't have anything definitive yet.
Right. So, what happened to the Harfoots? And Man, not in this part, but when you're building a world, something you can't cover the whole world in every episode. You gotta let them rest. You gotta give it a little rest. And now we're excited to see. Looks like Meteor Man's gonna get more reveals about him. Looks like he's gonna be fighting off of them wolves, and Nori's gonna be maybe almost eaten by wolves. Galadriel's gonna be doing some two sword fighting. Who was it? Was it Arthur Dayne in Game of Thrones that was doing that? I think that was the name.
Yes.
Fighting Elrond.
What's that?
He was fighting Elrond.
Yes, he was fighting Elrond.
The same actor who played young Ned Stark is playing Elrond in this. So we see Galadriel kicking some ass. That looked like Numenoreans to me. Was she being attacked by the home team there?
It did appear that way.
Oh, also, by the way, getting a little bit back to will to power and using benevolence to gain power over the sheeple of the world. Farazan shaking hands, kissing babies. He is a will to power character as well and will be punished, I believe, as all Tolkien's villains are eventually in some way.
Yeah, and to go back just a little bit, you know, speaking of Farazan, you mentioned, when we're talking about the lifespan of Numenoreans, do you even have an idea just how old our Numenorean protagonists would have been around the time that Farazan seizes power in Numenor?
I have a feeling you're about to tell us, Jude.
I have a feeling you are correct. So, our very young Isildur is a, you know, scant 46 years old when Pharazôn seizes power. Now, his father, Elendil, who I think so far in the show looks very good for his age, at 136.
Nah, he doesn't look a day over 132.
Yeah, so, you know, we have to see just how that plays out, but it's seeming suspicious, like they may either skirt over it if they do it at all. And as for Pharazôn himself, he's roughly the same age as Elendil. He's, I believe, a year older, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, in the show, I think he looks a little bit more than a year older. When he does seize power, when Tar Palantir dies, he becomes our Pharazôn. And, you know, you want to touch briefly on the differences between Tar and Ar, both titles for kings in Numenor, and what that difference is, Rob?
Yeah, Tar would be if you were faithful, it's Elvish. And Ar would be when the Numenorians began to disdain the elves, and they changed it to the Numenorian tongue.
They chopped off that T.
Yeah, that's all. They just moved the T. It's just a good coincidence. Anyway, I think we pretty much covered all the bases that we want to cover. We're going to see what's going to happen with Theo and Waldrig. Theo, I don't think he's going to be as easily corruptible as Waldrig thinks in this next episode. We're going to get more about, you know, who's Sauron? Is it, I don't know, Meteor Man was juxtaposed with a lot of Sauron imagery in the upcoming previews for the next episode. So we're going to see about that tomorrow night as well. And so it looks like we're going to wrap up this Helm's Deep dive. And my name is Rob Law, and I will be bidding you adieu. And Jude, do you have any last words that you'd like to say to bid adieu yourself to this fine audience?
Well, I think I will bid adieu. I've been Jude Fox, and you've been listening to the JRR You Talking to Me podcast. And if you'd like to reach us, you can do so at youtalkingtome@gmail.com. Find us on Facebook at the You Talking to Me About the Fellowship Facebook group. And as always, please like, rate us 5 stars, subscribe, and share with all your friends to help grow the fellowship. Bye-bye.